Welcome, Gretchen. But it's an account of the year that she spent test driving the wisdom of the ages, the current scientific studies that are out there, and the lessons from popular culture on how to be happier. So you're going to hopefully leave outside of this room with tools that you can take with you as you head home. And joining in on the conversation is the very lovely Carrie Conti over here to my left. And Carrie, a familiar name and face, is not your typical parenting expert. In fact, she challenges the whole idea that someone outside a family could possibly be an expert about how to parent within another's unit. So thank you both for being here, and thank you for being here as well, as we turn it over to Carrie.
Yay. Welcome. What a treat to be here, and what an honor to be sitting here with you.
So happy to be here with you.
It's a pleasure. So what we're going to do for the next about 40 minutes is I'm going to ask Gretchen some questions, and I'm excited to probe into there a little deeper. I loved your time today, this morning. It was great. And then at about, with 20 minutes left or so, I'm going to open it up to you guys and take some questions from the audience, because I'm sure you guys have some burning questions yourselves. And that'll be our time. I'm sure it's going to go quickly. But we're going to try to slow it down and just be real present and, see where we go. So, of course, my first and biggest question is, how did this all begin?
Well, I got the idea to do the Happiness Project in a very inconspicuous moment of my life. I was...
It's on, but it's not that loud. Hmm. Can you guys turn it up back there?
It's on. Sorry.
Okay. Hmm. We Hello? Could share. Is that better? Say something.
Something? Is that working?
No.
Should we just share? Pass it back and forth?
Yeah.
We could pass it back and forth.
Let's try that.
Okay. Or maybe less of me and more of you.
How's that? Okay. Well, this is going to be... We'll just run with it. We'll stay in the moment. So I was stuck on the city bus and in the pouring rain, and I had nothing to distract myself with, and I had one of those rare opportunities for reflection that you don't usually get in everyday life, and I thought, what do I want from life anyway? I want to be happy, but I realized I didn't spend any time thinking about whether I was happy or how I could be happier, and in a flash, I thought I should have a happiness project. And I went out to the library the next day, got a huge stack of books, and started researching to try to find out if what were the things that I ought to do to be happier, and if I did them, would it really work? And then with Happier at Home, if you were there this morning, I described how I had this moment of intense homesickness, which was so puzzling to me that it really got me to focus on the idea of home within the larger subject of happiness, and how really... I think for me and for a lot of people, home is really, it's almost the most universal thing, because people's lives are so different from each other, but we all have a home, and to be happy at home is such it's like the springboard to the rest of your life.
Yeah. So on that note, how do the two books differ? So I've read The Happiness Project, so Happier at Home, how did it diverge?
Well, with Happier at Home, I wanted to go much deeper into one narrow area. So I feel like with the Happiness Project, I was sort of setting out the broad principles and trying to grapple for myself with, like, what is the nature of happiness, or how do you even think about it, and trying to understand it in a very broad way, because it's a very abstract, transcendent, and it's hard. It took a lot of work to just sort of get my arms around it. And then by the time I got there, I felt like it was only once I'd written that book that I even had begun to think deeply about it. And so with Happier at Home, it was much less about me individually and more about my place in the world and the people around me. And it was, I feel like I was just able to take all the ideas much more into a much more profound, interesting place because I had done all that preparatory work. Sometimes it's only when you finish a book that you know enough to actually write the book, but then it's too late. So I was excited with Happier at Home to have a way to go to really feel like I was getting my arms around this part of the subject.
Yeah, that makes sense. Because my work and my passion is really looking at family life and how to make family life
easier, more fun, more joyful. That's my question is, how did family life change in your family as a result of you undertaking both of these projects?
Well, it changed a lot. And one of the things is that so many of my resolutions were aimed at, like, I'm very irritable. I make this allegedly terrifying, mean face. And so one of the big things that I wanted to work on is I wanted to be more patient. I wanted to be more lighthearted. I wanted to goof off more. I wanted to have more attentive relationships within our family. And so many of my resolutions were aimed at how to do that. For example, like one very small example is a lot of times I work at home. I have this little tiny office, and my daughters would come in and talk to me, and I would kind of bark at them because I'm one of these people that concentrates really. I'm super focused, and when somebody jerks me out of my concentration, it always makes me really annoyed. And so I said to myself, well, what can I do about this situation? And I thought, well, I could tell them not to come to my office, but actually I like for them to come to my office, which is why I didn't like the fact that I was responding in this way, because I liked it when they came to my office, but then here I was behaving in this really rude way. So I said to them, just knock. I'll keep the door shut and just knock. And now, I think a mother who was more focused on manners might have thought of that sooner. I don't know. You know, for me, it was like giant revelation. What I found about myself was that I just needed that little moment of transition. I needed the knock, and then I needed that minute to like finish off my thought and like change into answering. And I mean, it's such a small thing, but it was making me feel really guilty and just like bad. You know, like I didn't like seeing myself behave that way. And ironically, when I behaved that way, then I would behave worse because I felt guilty and bad. So then I would behave even worse. And then I felt worse and et cetera. This little tiny thing. And it's funny, like you think, oh, you have to nag, you have to keep at them to do it. They totally, like now the door's shut, they knock, it's not a big deal. So there's a lot of little things like that that were really had quite a big effect.
Yeah, and kind of going a little bit deeper into that, did you see them start to take on the project on their own, sort of just as a, you know, I talk a lot about in my work, the parent and mainly the mom sets the tone. You set the emotional tone of the family. So can you speak a little bit about anything that you saw with regards to, you know, them being a little more aware of feeling more happy or more joyful, and what did that look like?
Well, one thing about my family is they're not part of this. Like, my husband, I think, if anything, feels like kind of a martyr to happiness. And he certainly isn't. He's not the kind of person that would do a resolution. He doesn't even have New Year's resolutions. He's just not that kind of guy. And with my children, I don't talk to them about it much because I think there's sort of an unself-consciousness in children. So I don't really, except for very few occasions, I don't really ask them to do resolutions along with me. But they definitely respond, because when I change, they change. And like when I can, like one of my resolutions that I talk about in Happier at Home is to underreact to a problem. So, you know, not to dismiss it, but just to try to take the reaction down. And what I found is like when I can take my reaction down, then everybody can kind of downwardly adjust. And so instead of having a big, big blow up or a big, you know, oh, you did this, no, blah, 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 you know, it just take it down, and that really changes the dynamic. I think it's, but there is this thing, there's the saying, you know, if mama ain't happy, ain't nobody happy. And I think it's sort of true of everybody in the family because of emotional contagion. We all catch emotions from each other. But I do feel like parents will set an emotional tone and also show what is the appropriate response. One of the most amazing, I read this, my favorite parenting book of all time is called How to Talk So Kids Will Listen and Listen So Kids Will Talk. Has anybody read that book? Amazing book. I've read it like 10 times. And there's a principle in there that helped me so much, with adults too, not just children, which is to acknowledge the reality of other people's feelings. And this has helped me so much with my children. And not to say things like, you're not scared, it will be fun, you're not hungry, you love going to grandma's house. I mean, just say, you feel like it's not going to be fun. You just say, but you say you're still hungry. You don't feel like putting on your snow boots. This little thing. You just acknowledge that you understand their feelings. Don't deny them.
it is amazing to me how well that just allows me to get out of so many arguments, because I'm not arguing, because I'm like, you don't want to wear your snow boots. I'm sorry that you have to wear snow boots today. It's like, okay. And that, it's amazing to me.
So what comes to my mind is, you know, you're the happiness guru at this point. So when you're out in public at your kid's school or doing just daily life, are you self-conscious about, you know, I need to be happy, or I need to be showing the world how my wonderful stuff is working? How does that work in terms of your authenticity?
Well, that's funny, because I'm actually, like, in my life, I'm a very kind of distracted, high-strung, edgy kind of person. And that's just sort of my nature. So I definitely do not feel like I have to constantly be happy, or like seemingly outwardly bubbly or something like that. And it's funny, because like almost nobody that I actually know talks to me about it. Which is interesting to me. I should ask them about it, because like I have friends, you know, in the book I never to protect their privacy, I don't make it clear who a person is, but like they know. Like, you know, I talk about my friend where I was like, I got panicky when I saw how many cardigans she had. She knows who she is. You know? Or like my friend we went to this perfume place together, and we drove there, and I talked about how we went together, and it's funny, they never mentioned to me, like I don't know, it's just this interesting thing where it's like a sort of it's just a question of writing a memoir when there are people in it. There's nothing in it that I think would upset somebody, but it's interesting to me. There's kind of a boundary that they all seem to not penetrate. It's just, but I certainly don't feel like I need to be constantly acting in an overtly happy way beyond what I normally would.
So in the new, so the first book was a year, 12 months, and this book 9 months. So why? I'm just curious.
Well, I don't know about you, but for me, September is like the other January. And in a way, it feels more like a fresh beginning. You know, in whether or not you have kids in school now, but it's just back to your own childhood and that feeling of fresh notebooks and new pencils and like you're sort of in a new grade. And it's just like your birthday or like the new year, where it's a milestone that feels like it there's an opportunity for change. And so I thought, well, for a happier at home, home life does so much revolve around the academic calendar, and kind of the sense that June, July, and August are sort of separate, and then they come to an end, and then you have the September through May, and whatever the school calendar actually is these days, it still feels like that's the school year and that's the summer, at least to me. And so I thought, well, I want to just... And it seemed like there were 9 areas, and so I thought, well, that just feels right, and I'll spend a school year really focused in on this, and start in September with that new beginning, and take it through to May, and that will give me just the right amount of time to sort of get through the areas of life that I felt like I wanted to get through.
Yeah, great. So a couple times you've mentioned the resolutions. Would you be willing to share those with us?
I mean, I have a million resolutions, more even than I ever write about, if you can believe it. And it's surprising to me how well this kind of approach works, at least for me. And I certainly don't think that most people would do a happiness project to the extent that I do. I mean, the idea is like I do all these things so you don't have to. You just like pick your own like 5 things that you would want to test out. Like one of the things that I did that I thought that this was just my own private problem, but it turns out it's quite widespread, is to suffer for 15 minutes, which is a strategy when you have something that you're dreading doing and you just can't, but and it's so huge you can't even start, like cleaning out the basement or something. So, but for me, that gigantic task was my digital photos. I felt so oppressed by my digital photos. They were just more and more and more, like with every day that passed, and I didn't even know what to do with them. I literally did not know what to do with them. I wanted physical albums because I just thought it seemed too sketchy to just have them in some digital form somewhere, some computer that we would eventually lose or whatever. But I was so paralyzed by this task that I couldn't even start. So it's getting worse and worse with every passing month. And so I decided to do it for 15 minutes. And little by little, I mean, sure enough, we overestimate what we can do in the short term, like in a weekend, and we underestimate what we can do if you do just like an hour a day, you know, once a week or 15 minutes a day. And so it didn't take that long before I had my, you know, I remember the day when I got the note from Shutterfly, like, your photo albums are in the mail. I was like, I really did it. And now that I know how to do it, it's not a big deal. And I really do it with I do it a couple times a year so I don't get myself into that same pickle. But I thought that this was just me and everybody else was super tech savvy and had figured this all out. Well, it turns out, no. I talked to a woman about this and she started crying in front of me. She was so upset. She's like, I have a 2-year-old, I'm pregnant, I have 2 million photographs and I don't know what to do, you know. I was like, suffer for 15 minutes. And then I was in Connecticut and there's a woman who was a professional photo organizer. That was her whole job. And I said, well, digital or what do you, physical? And she said, whatever you want. Like, I just come over and organize people's photographs for them. And on the one hand, I thought that seemed kind of preposterous, but on the other hand, I thought, I'm kind of amazed I haven't heard of that before, because once I started asking around, I realized this was something that a lot of people suffered with. So it's just a really good strategy when there's something that you feel like is really weighing on you, but feels insurmountable. Like, you know, just those big tasks that just, you can't imagine finishing it, so you can't even start.
So one thing that I notice is that technology, and that means email and Facebook and everything we have access to now, it can be a happiness bringer or it can be a happiness killer.
Yeah.
So how does that all fit in to this project and then just your personal life in general?
Oh, I think it's a huge challenge for people. Part of it is that technology is a good servant but a bad master, and so you have to figure out how to master it. And some people do that by having like a technology Sabbath where they take a day off from all devices, or they don't do it for certain hours of the day so that they really engage with their family. I don't do it after, like every day I pick a certain point and then I say after that I won't go online anymore, I won't check my email every morning. And that's what works for me. Turning off your alert sounds is very helpful. But one thing I would say too, because I'm a sleep zealot, There is the bad trance. The bad trance happens when you are in front of the TV set flicking through the channels, or you're online reading celebrity gossip or online shopping, or just like going from one link to another link to another link. And it's that feeling, it's like it's not a good trance where you feel energized and transported and like and you feel like you're learning. It's the bad trance where you sort of can't stop yourself and you're feeling depleted and you feel guilty if anybody catches you because it's so obvious that it's a big waste of time. And the bad trance happens the most, I think, at the end of the day, at night, because you're so tired that you can't do anything else. But the secret of adulthood is, if you're so tired that all you can do is flick through channels on the television or cruise the internet, go to bed. Because that time will be so much better spent asleep than it is in that bad trance of technology. So I think we were talking earlier about mindfulness. Part of it is just recognizing these habits, or like, wow, after 10 o'clock, I'm really not getting any fun out of this stuff, I should just not do it. Or, wow, from 6 to 8 every night, I have to just stay out, I just have to put my phone away, because otherwise it's just going to keep dragging me out of where I really want to be. And so I think the rules are different for everybody, because everybody's situation, their work situation, their family situation is so different, but it's more like deciding what rules would work.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I noticed just in my own life and with the people I work with, the constant checking is similar to guilt. It's this symptom of stress, and it means I'm in a non-human part of my brain. And if I, you know, I literally will say, like, shut it down, Conti. Like, just put it away. Yeah. And it's not what my impulse is necessarily, but when I do it, right, I fall right to sleep. So a lot of people in my realm, because I work with families, sleep is hard to come by. And it is probably the biggest issue in their life, often not getting enough sleep or wishing they could get enough sleep. So, you know, I really heard you this morning. What would you say to families where they do have small children who don't sleep a lot? How do you encourage those families to get more rest? Because I agree, I've seen people go from really happy, joyful people, and in a matter of weeks or months, go into, you know, what they feel is depression because simply because of the sleep. And then the other side, I've seen families where they weren't getting a lot of sleep and there's all these problems, and the minute they start getting sleep, it's like, oh, I'm not even sure why I called you. So
no, it's a huge issue. I mean, one of the things that's comforting about the problem with small children is a lot of times if you just wait, it will change. So like 6 months from now, that baby's sleep patterns could be very different. So part of it is also just to think to yourself, it's not going to be like this forever. And so if I can just figure out a way to get through it. But I think one of the problems with sleep is people almost treat it like it's this choice that you make. Like, well, you know, I really can only get 5 hours of sleep a night. It's like, well, you can think whatever you want, but if your body needs 7 hours of sleep, it's not up to you. You don't get to just decide. And so figuring out how you need, like, I remember talking to a friend where she had a new baby, and she got up every night with the baby because she was on maternity leave and her husband was still working. And then she said she realized, like, you can't do that. Like, she had to sleep. It doesn't matter, like, what they thought was the more convenient or fair or appropriate division of sleep. It's like, she has to sleep. And so they had to figure out a way that they could divide it so that each of them could get more sleep or you know, deal with the issue. I think a big thing for adults is, like, give yourself a bedtime. I'm really surprised by how many adults, they treat it like, you know, just, what's their whim? You know, well, I go to bed at like 1. What time do you get up? 6. Okay, that's not enough. Like, so what I always think is figure out what time you wake up, because most people wake up at the same time every day, and do the math, and then that's your bedtime. And so then you say to yourself, wow, I'm up a half an hour past my bedtime. I'm up an hour past my bedtime. Look at that. It's 3 hours past my bedtime. So you have this consciousness of, like, that you were supposed to be asleep. Because I think for a lot of people, it's like, and then you get the dreaded second wind. You know, it's like 10:45 or 11, and you get an email that's like great, or you get a little bit of something, and you wake up and you're thinking, oh my gosh, well, it's 12:30, but I'm not tired. I don't need to go to bed. Like, I'll stay up and get a bunch of stuff done because I'll be super efficient. So you're in the second wind, but man, that second wind is going to be gone at 7 a.m. And so I think part of it is just, and also people sleep better when they sleep regularly. So if you get up at the same time and you go to bed at the same time, you tend to sleep better. So if you're a person who has problems sleeping, that kind of regularity, instead of always waiting until you're so exhausted. Also, am I the only one who has this where I get so exhausted that then I'm too tired to go to sleep? Because I'm like, it's so much work to take out my contacts, I'm just going to stay awake for another hour. Like, that's going to help. So I think having a regular bedtime kind of helps you with that. One thing that's happened to me is I'm such a sleep zealot now that my husband will start saying, like, well, are you going to go to sleep now? And then I'm like, well, now that you mention it, I think I will go to sleep. So it's like, I think one thing about good habits is that then other people also fall into habits because we all affect each other. So if you're sleeping well, then other people sleep well. So with children, I think that they sleep better when they feel like nothing fun is going on. If it's like the TV's on and somebody's in the kitchen and it's like party time downstairs, then they're like, why am I in bed? You know, I'm 4 years old. It's 10:30. I've got a lot of energy to burn. But if there's just this sense that the whole household is moving towards sleep after, you know, after dinner, that it's just kind of winding down. For my children, I feel like that also kind of creates an atmosphere where it's less of a struggle.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I often tell people, because a lot of times I'm working with moms, and it might be the only time of the day that they get their own time. So they put the children to bed, they might even fall asleep, they wake up, and then they're on. And I'll say, and then there's this little rebellious teenager inside that's like, nobody's taking my time away. And what I say is, don't say to yourself, go to bed every night at 9, but if you do it twice a week, you're benefiting. And I had an endocrinologist tell me about 10 years ago that every hour you get before midnight counts for 2 after. So whether that's true or not, that's pretty good information. So if you went to bed at 10, that's 4 hours before midnight versus, you know, going to bed at midnight. So something to think about. So totally shifting topics, but I love all the research that you did. What did you see with regards to the differentiation between happiness and joy?
I started my career in law, so I have happy memories of spending an entire semester arguing about the definition of contract. And so, and perhaps because of that, I really don't spend any time defining happiness or trying to make those kinds of distinctions, because I feel like there's something like 15 academic definitions of happiness, and of course, if you're a scientist, it's very important to have this very precise thing like hedonic tone or subjective well-being or whatever it is. But I feel like for the lay person, it can almost be distracting to focus on like joy, bliss, peace, satisfaction, contentment. You know, there's all these different labels that you can give it, and you can start getting in all these arguments about, some people love nothing more to argue with you about the difference between contentment and satisfaction. You know, like they'll do that for 2 hours. So I feel like it's more helpful to think about being happier. So instead of thinking about, like, well, what's the end point, to say, like, well, what's the direction? So instead of, like, worrying about achieving happiness or joy or like, getting to that point, because it's sort of like, well, what would that be, and how would I know if I was there, and how could I stay there? It's more like, well, this resolution, this week, this month, this year, is this something that's going to tend to make me happier? And I feel like that helps you just be moving in the right direction, and then you don't, and not worrying so much about, because I think even saying like what is happiness, it sort of dissolves the more you think about it. So I don't focus too much on that kind of thing, because I really feel like it's all about the growth towards that goal.
Yeah, I have a sort of personal little motto. It's like, or actually, it's like a meter. Is it more joy or less joy?
Yeah.
And if it brings more joy, I do it. And if it brings less joy, I don't. And that's how I make a lot of my decisions. And it's a moment to moment, because I could be out on Facebook having a great time, and then all of a sudden I'm like, this isn't bringing as much joy.
Bad trance.
Yeah. Right, exactly. So I can feel it in my body, and it's a very sensorial experience versus something I'm thinking about. Okay, let's get practical. What are like three things that you feel like I can't leave Austin without telling these people, these three things about bringing more happiness into their lives?
Well, I have to say sleep again. There are two ways to think about happiness. If you said, what is the most important thing to happiness? You can get two answers depending on what perspective you use. One is to say relationships, and I talked about this morning. In a way, the key to happiness is strong relationships with other people. And I think for people who are really busy, like who's here, I think starting or joining a group is a great way to feel connected to friends, because a lot of people, like, their family has to, like, they have to, it's work and family, and it's hard for them to make time for their friends, even if this is a really important value. And it sounds weird to talk about efficiency and friendship together, but the fact is, it's hard to have, friendship takes time, and that's why it's a challenge. And if you're in a group, it's great, because you see a bunch of people. A lot of times you'll meet new people, so that's fun too, as well as seeing your old friends. If you miss a time, you'll see them next time. If you meet every month or 6 weeks, that's enough to really feel like you're in touch with somebody. And there's just something about being part of a group that meets regularly, whether it's a book group or there are happiness project groups. I mean, I know a friend who was in a dessert making group. It was all people who love to bake. So they would get together once every 6 weeks, and they would take turns making these elaborate desserts that you don't really get to do anymore, you know, in your everyday life. And then they would eat them and talk about baking. And like, for her, that was tons of fun. A friend of mine said, she's like, I'm going to start a group for people who read People magazine. She's like, I would always be prepared, and I have a lot to say. And I'm like, that is a great idea for a group, like, or like reality television, whatever. Just like a little excuse. Like, and then it's something fun that you want to talk about, so you make room for it in your life and your schedule, and then you have a reason to see these people over and over. Because if you're trying to have like one-on-one coffees and lunches with people, it's very, very hard to maintain. But something about a group makes it easier. So I think that's one thing. Another way that you could answer what is the secret to happiness is self-knowledge. And you think, what is easier than, I mean, all I do is hang out with myself all day. Like, how can I not know myself? But it's very hard to know yourself. And it's very easy to be distracted by what you think you should be, or what you wish you were, or what other people expect you to be, and to lose track of what is really true for you. And yet, to build a happy life, you really have to have a life that reflects your nature, your values, your interests. And so to really say to yourself, like, you know, is it really important to me to send holiday cards, or am I just doing this out of habit? Or is it really important to me to, do I like skiing, or do I just think everybody likes skiing, and so I'm going, but I don't really like it? I mean, because there's so many, nothing is inherently fun. It's only fun for you. And I have gotten a huge argument with a guy who was trying to explain to me how great wine was and how you know, it was so interesting. And I was like, you can't convince me of this. It's totally boring to me. I do not like wine. Like, you can't, like, it's fun for you. It's not inherently fun. And so when you really take the time, I had a friend who said to me, well, she said, Gretchen, you know me, I hate the outdoors. I thought, that's great. Embrace that. Stay inside. You know, you don't have to go outside. You know, and so she just let go of this idea that you should go to the park, or you should, I mean, you know, it's bold. So part of it is really to always admit to yourself, like, well, I really don't like this, or I'm really not enjoying this. And then you can figure out ways to change your life so that it more reflects your values. Just like I was saying about how I love children's literature. For a long time, you know, I didn't really admit this to myself because it didn't fit with my idea of who I wanted to be. But that's who I am, and once I embraced it, I became much happier. So part of it is just is really taking the time to really say, well, what? And I think your meter is a good thing. Like, is this bringing me joy? Is it making me energized? Am I looking forward to it, or does it just feel like another chore? Because sometimes things that are supposedly fun really aren't fun, and you don't even realize it unless you
maybe were fun and aren't fun anymore.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So. There was something you just said. Oh, so basically relationship, well, sleep first and foremost. I agree. Sleep is my favorite thing. And then relationships and really knowing yourself and really choosing to fill yourself with the things you love, not the things that maybe your family loved or your friends love or you should love. Yeah, that makes perfect sense to me. With regards to the home, what are some things that bubbled out of your project this year? Oh, and then before I forget, let me just make a note, because I really want to know is, I'll ask you this first. Have there been any groups that have started around your book?
No, there have been tons of groups, which is something that I never had anticipated when I wrote it. And there's all these happiness project groups. And now that I've been traveling for Happier at Home, I've met a lot of the groups. I've been emailing with some of them, and it's when a lot of times they have really funny names. Like, one was called the Low Impact Book Group, and they only read a chapter a month, and then one was called Happiness Bitches. And when you met them, you were like, I totally get that name, because they're very edgy, very edgy. So it was really fun. So there are all these people, and I think that's a great idea, because again, it's like the fun of being in a group, and it gives you something, like you're doing something together, and also it, like, you hold each other accountable and stuff. So I think that's a great thing. From Happier at Home, some of the resolutions that I talked this morning about how I love the resolution to enjoy a sense of smell, and you were talking about the body. I mean, there's something about things that happen to you through your body that have a special power. So I think, like, paying attention to the sense of smell is good. I mean, now music is something like B. Gretchen. I don't really like music very much, I have to admit. It's not that fun for me. But I can see that a lot of people would probably finding ways to have more music in their life or whatever, these things that come to us through our senses. One thing that I really enjoyed was my resolution to be a tourist without leaving home. Because, you know, being a tourist is really a frame of mind. Because, you know, when you're a tourist, it's like you go out and you read and you look around and you're like, you're so attuned to everything. And, I mean, admittedly, I live in New York City, which is like, you could not have a more touristy kind of place. But I realized, like, I could have the pleasure of travel without leaving home if I just put my mind to it. And I really said, like, I want to learn about the statue that I love. I love Bethesda Fountain in New York, in Central Park, but I didn't know anything about it. But I could look it up. I could study it just the way I would if I was in Venice and I was going to read about it. Or we can say, let's go. One thing that my husband's really good about is saying, like, let's go to this new neighborhood. I read about this restaurant. Let's go, and we'll just go to some extremely random part of New York City and go to this restaurant just because it's fun to be a tourist and at home. So I thought that was something that was really fun and very attainable. And one of my resolutions is this idea that now is now. And over I come back to this idea, and I've talked to so many people who also have this thing where it's very hard to appreciate now. and to appreciate this season of life, and to not be so distracted by crossing things off your to-do list and getting things done and answering your emails and putting in another load of laundry that you really appreciate now. But you realize later that every time of life is so fleeting. And this phrase, now is now, comes from Laura Ingalls Wilder. I don't want to give a spoiler for Happier at Home, but the end. As a writer, I specialize in endings. That's my favorite thing, and I'm really good at it. And I always sort of go into a good trance, not a bad trance, when I'm writing the ending, and it all just comes. Like, I will write it in an hour, and it rarely even gets edited because it just pours out of me, and it's always this thrilling, thrilling intellectual experience. And the ending for Happier at Home is the best ending that I have ever written in my life. And that phrase, now is now, is part of it. And I just always am coming back to that to try to understand and really appreciate now. And how do you memorialize it with mementos and photographs? How do you stay in the moment? How do you keep your temper so that you're behaving yourself in the moment? This is one of the biggest happiness challenges. Every tradition talks about this problem of trying to really stay in the present and not always just be so with your head in the clouds and preoccupied with the future and the past. Yeah.
Exactly. So I'm just going to put a plug in for my talk at 3 is basically that. It's slowing down. How do you slow down enough in family life to really savor the now? So, yeah, come join me. But I want to do right now is open it up and see if anybody has any questions. And I think the mics are on, so you could step back there so that we can hear you. Does anybody have a question for Gretchen? Yeah. Would you go to the mic, please?
I need to speak loud.
Okay.
There's been so much research on the subject. I'm just really curious. Is there anything you found that talks about blood chemistry and happiness?
About, like, sort of your chemical...
Yeah. So
the question is, what about blood chemistry and happiness? You know, there's a huge amount of research into things like that. I mean, it looks like about 50% of happiness is genetically determined, so that's part of the biology of it. And there's a ton of research. I have to say that I don't look at it that much because I'm not a scientist to evaluate it, and I'm pretty skeptical of a lot of claims, especially claims related to nutrition. And I think it's, for my purposes, I think it's easier to almost be anecdotal about it. So for something like exercise, rather than to try to pinpoint what is chemically happening in the body in terms in exercise that makes people happy, I just can say to myself, do I feel happier when I exercise? Yes, I do. When I talk to people who regularly exercise, why do they say they do it? They point to emotional reasons, not physical reasons. They do it because it keeps me sane, or it makes me calm, or it makes me feel more energized, rather than, you know, I look, you know, it's like great for my body, or you know, it's good for my cardio, or whatever. So I tend, just for my own purposes, not to focus too much on that, like, really, really scientific debate, but to look at it more in terms of, like, what do I see happening in human nature? Though I'm always interested when there's when it identifies maybe part of life that I hadn't considered before, but yeah, I'm not, because that's super, super technical.
Yeah, I can't speak to the science of it, but I would say, you know, just personally and watching people out there, the more joy, the more happiness I feel, it seems to beget more.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, is the streamliner going this way or is it going this way? And if I can turn it, you know, oh, I just find more things to be happy about. So, and I do think that, you know, oxytocin plays into it and things like that. But again, it's more about the physical feeling than anything. Another one. We'll do here and then I'll move toward the back. Yeah, go. Yeah. I think so. And then I think, was there somebody over in this area? Okay, so you'll be next. Great. Yeah. No. Yeah, that's great.
Okay, the positivity movement takes happiness to such an extreme that it can be obnoxious. I've got friends that are so overwhelmingly positive that I just want to smack them around. And the question is, I'm especially interested because you said that you weren't naturally bubbly, like outwardly happy. So my question is,
Well, that's an interesting question. There is a tug of war between the Tiggers and the Eeyores. And the Tiggers want people to cheer up, and they want people to look on the bright side. And the Eeyores want people to be realistic, and they like a little dash of cynicism and sarcasm. And in my observation, what can happen is that these two groups can polarize and antagonize each other. Now, when it's not too extreme, it's fine. But what happens is if you get two people who are on pretty extreme levels, they start to really, really pull against each other. Now, from the Tigger's point of view, the Eeyore's negativity is unsettling because the Tigger feels dragged down by the Eeyore. And they feel this tractor beam towards the Death Star coming at them. And so they want the Eeyore to cheer up, both for the Eeyore's own sake and because they feel that negativity affecting them and they don't like it, so they want the Eeyore to cheer up. The Eeyore usually feels extremely correct in the Eeyore's perception of the world. And so they don't want to be convinced. And it annoys them to have somebody constantly telling them to look on the bright side or things aren't so bad. And so it almost drives them further into their position. So what do you do? I think the thing is, coming back to this, what I was saying before, acknowledge the reality of other people's feelings. If a Tigger and an Eeyore just admit, can acknowledge the other person's point of view and not try to convert them, they don't exhaust each other in the same way. Because what happens is, like, if you constantly are trying to convince somebody to see it your way, they're not going to be converted, and they're just going to be annoyed. And when I wrote about this on my blog, the number of Eeyores that wrote in completely annoyed by everybody's, you know, well-meaning attempts to cheer them up, they don't appreciate it, you know? They don't like it at all. And then the Tiggers are just like, can the Eeyore, you know, like, just lighten up? You're just dragging everybody down. So I think it's just better to say, you know, just to acknowledge, just say something like, well, you're worried that the weather is going to be so bad that we're not going to be able to park, or you're worried that the team isn't going to be able to get the project done on time. Acknowledge what they're saying, because part of why people will persist is they will emphasize over and over and over what they're saying if they feel like you're not understanding what they're trying to tell you. And if the Eeyore says to the Tigger, like, wow, you're feeling really good, you think the presentation's going to go really well, then just let the person be. Because I think sometimes the Tiggers feel like it's their duty to try to cheer everybody up when those people don't want to be cheered up. And the Eeyores, you know, the fact of the matter is, if your persistent negativity drags other people down, they're not going to want to be around you. And whether or not that should be true, to some extent it is true. So be aware of the fact that if you are perceived to be somebody who is constantly a drag, then other people are going to react to that too. So part of it is just to be self-aware of where you're coming from and, you know, not try to cure other people.
Yeah. Yeah, and one of my favorite children's book is an old book called There's No Such Thing as Dragons, and it's this story about this little boy. And he sees a dragon on his bed, and it's real little. And he says, oh, Mom, look, there's a dragon. And the mom's like, no, there's no dragon. There's no dragon. And the dragon gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and it takes the house down the street. And finally, the dad comes home, and he's like, where is everybody? And then he climbs up the dragon, and the little boy's like, there's no such thing as... And the mom finally acknowledges, oh, the dragon. And the dragon just shrinks right down. And I think the same thing is true, which is... go for more joy, but be with what is. So if you're not feeling joyful, don't make what you're saying or what I'm saying like no value judgment, good, happy is good, sad is bad. Just be with what is, because my experience of the more I accept what is, the quicker I get back to joy or the quicker I get back to happy. So, yes.
Well, again, I don't spend a lot of time trying to define states of emotion, so I wouldn't characterize it particularly. Like, what if I think it's like Wasn't it Justice Potter Stewart who said about obscenity, I know it when I see it? I feel like, you know, I think that happiness is some, like being happier, you know when you're happier than when you're less happy, and that's maybe when the idea of the meter is helpful rather than worrying about have you achieved a state. Now, drifting through life versus driven and ambitious. I'm not sure that human nature divides in exactly those ways. A friend of mine once said that ambitious people can't be happy. And I thought, I don't think that's true, but I understood what he said, what he meant by that. I think that drift, if by drifting you mean people who are not mindfully making choices, I think people who mindfully make choices tend to be happier than people who don't mindfully make choices. And I the more you craft your life to be what you want it to be, then I think the happier you are. And it's hard with happiness, too, to make distinctions because they're sort of apples and oranges. Who's happier? The person who has a pleasant job with nice coworkers, who goes in at 9 and leaves at 5 and does, like, works in a quiet office, or the head of an emergency room surgery? Whose life is happier? How can you say? I mean, one person's life is probably much more full of stress and anxiety and anger than the other person's life, but I wouldn't say that necessarily I wouldn't say that the other person's life was necessarily the happier life, because there's so many things that go into it, and that so much of it is who you are and what you want and what's right for you. So I think that being driven, but I do think that people who are very ambitious can fall prey to something that I would call the arrival fallacy, which is not very good for happiness. And this is the idea that I will be happy when, or I will be happy once. I will be happy once I make partner. I will be happy once we move. I will be happy once my kids are in school. I'll be happy when I get that recognition. I'll be happy when I get a book published. And the problem is usually hitting those landmarks doesn't make you as happy as you expected it will be. And also, if you make decisions in your life expecting that you'll be happy once those things happen, and so that's why you're doing it, but you don't enjoy it along the way, first of all, you're not enjoying your life along the way, which is not fun. And then second of all, if things don't go the way you plan, which they often do not, then you feel tremendously disheartened because you've lost all this time and you didn't even get what you want. If you work like a dog and hate every minute of trying to make partner in a law firm and then you don't make partner, then you are very, very disappointed. For me, like, I wrote this book called 40 Ways to Look at JFK, and I loved writing this book, but shall we say it did not succeed in the marketplace. But, you know, do I regret writing that book? No, I do not, because I had so much pleasure in writing that book, and I did what I set out to do, and I had an enormous sense of satisfaction from it, from the process, from just enjoying the process and doing what I wanted, and because sometimes things don't work out the way you want. So I think for some people who are driven and ambitious, they can sometimes be consumed by getting to the rung of the ladder without thinking, like, am I on the right ladder? Because the arrival fallacy can be very, very distracting.
Yeah. My sense is that probably one of the reasons why your book is so popular is because it's doing what I think is pretty necessary in our culture right now. It's getting people to figure it out for themselves with guidance, with suggestions, but it's really that paradigm shift from they know what's best for me, I better figure out how to do it that way, versus I know what's best for me, and I just need some ideas and some tips and some experimentation to find the right groove for me, my family, whatever it is. So, you know, I can see why people are flocking to what you're doing, because, and I think the topic of happiness is the perfect entree to that, but I could even see it on all different levels, because I think just somebody saying, what do you want? What do you value? What do you love? What brings you joy is infinitely valuable right now in our society. Yeah.
Do you want to say something about that?
We'll go there. Barely. Can you talk loud?
Thank you.
Where would you start?
I have no idea.
Well, I'd have to talk to you and find out what your issues are. Are you getting enough sleep? I don't think there's any, in my books I try to put out a bunch of kind of easy, everything I do is very manageable and realistic, like they're all small things. But I really think, back to Carrie's point, I think you really, 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 I don't think there is an answer where this is where everybody would start, because I think that it's like, what is dragging you down now? Like, for example, a friend of mine who works was saying to me that her mornings were very chaotic and everybody was whining and nagging and it was very unpleasant. And then she realized to herself, I don't really see my kids during the week very much. This is a really important time for me. So I have to fix the morning. So she did a lot of things to make her morning experience different. And that made her much happier and made her family life much happier. I think part of it is just sort of saying, like, well, what are the first three things that I would start? Clutter sounds trivial, but for some reason there's just something weird about it. There's just something weird about clutter, where a lot of times people report that they get a lot more calm and energy when they get rid of clutter, so that might be a place to start. It might be more goofing off, are you having fun? Some people, I was talking to a woman who was clearly starved for solitude. She worked all the time. She felt she had to spend all her time with her children. But when you spoke to her, she was clearly one of these people that needed a lot of time to herself. And she hadn't had a minute to herself for 5 years. And so she was talking about how she loved kayaking. And I was like, just take 2 hours once every 2 weeks and do something by yourself. Because she was so starved for solitude. So sometimes even finding happiness within your family is doing something by, So, I try with everything that I do to throw out a bunch of ideas that would be good places to start, but I feel like really it has to be what the things would be that would be particular to every person's circumstances, because the place to start is the place that is right now causing you the most, making you feel bad.
And I just want to add to that. So if you know how you don't want it to be going, if you can get clear and set an intention for how you do want, not just for how it should unfold, actually that's not the ideal, more of how you want to feel. So if you know you want family life to feel more spacious or more slow or more easy, you might have to, for 2 months, every day be saying, wow, we live a really relaxed lifestyle, and you might be going a million miles an hour. But if you keep affirming that, eventually you're going to turn around and be like, whoa, look at us, we're doing it. So it might just be starting with setting an intention for how you want it to feel, and then playing with that and faking it till you make it, because it might not turn for right away. It might take a little while, but most of us keep going, I don't want that, I don't want that, and I don't want, and that's no different than going, whatever you guys do right now, do not think about lemons. There's nothing you need to do when you think about, and you're like, I wasn't even thinking about lemons. I don't even like lemons. So, if somebody said, no, think about limes, you're like, oh, I love limes. Limes are great. So try to turn it when you notice, I don't want this, I don't want this, I don't want this. Ask yourself, what do I want? And then life will start flowing toward that, maybe not right away, but soon enough. Sure. I'll go this way, then we'll have one more, and then we'll have to close.
So if you didn't hear this morning, I was talking about how we do a little holiday breakfast for minor holidays. One thing that we do is for holiday cards, I realized I just can't do holiday cards in the regular holiday season because it's too crazy. So we send out Valentine's Day cards. So just like you would send out a Christmas card. And it's so much easier that a lot of my friends have started doing it too. Because it's just a lot easier to get that organized in February. And a lot of people say that they like it better because you get so many holiday cards at the holidays, they all run together, but when you only get a few at Valentine's Day, so it's nice. Another holiday, one thing that we started doing in our family is for adults, we draw for each other so that instead of buying gifts for all adults, you only buy gifts for one adult. And that makes it a lot easier because you just have your one person who you're assigned. Like, and it's a big tradition. Like, it's on Thanksgiving. We do this whole thing where you draw for your adult, and that makes it much better. I'm a big believer in decorations, but I do them exactly the same way every year. And I don't like to shop, and my mother loves to shop and loves putting together collections. So she just handed me this amazing Halloween collection. And I felt sort of guilty, like, oh, shouldn't I be out there assembling these precious memories? And I'm like, no, I should be, like, so happy, you know. Like, and she, like, took pictures of how they should be arranged, and I just look at the pictures and arrange them.
Awesome.
Every once in a while, I'll, like, move something, and that's very exciting. So, you know, I think part of it is to keep it manageable because holiday traditions are something where it's easy to, like, get into a habit of something and then it just becomes so burdensome. Oh, I just heard about the greatest thing. I think I was in Atlanta. So this is a family where they're all adults. It's six adult children and their families and their parents, and they could never get together for the holidays, and it was such a huge drag because they're all over the country, so they celebrate something called Thanksmas, and they get together the week after Thanksgiving, and they pretend like it's Christmas, and they have a Christmas exchange and a big Thanksgiving dinner. But the way that it works out is they can all be together, and it's easy to travel because, you know, you're not in that crush time. And then they don't get into problems with the spouses because everybody's, like, because it doesn't interfere with anybody else's family tradition. And I was like, what a great solution. Like, you want your family to be together, pick a different date. Don't fly two days, the Saturday before Christmas. And I just thought that was such a smart way of thinking about what's the result that I want, how can I have more joy, and let's think outside the box. And so they have Thanksmas, and I love that idea.
Yeah, if you go to slowfamilyliving.com, we have a Creating Your Family Holidays ebook, and it'll give you both some suggestions, but it'll also just get you thinking about what you want to do. So it's both practical stuff, but also helping you create your own traditions and really making it what you need it to be. So is that it? That's all the time. Thank you. That was so much fun. Thanks, everybody. Thanks for those great questions. Gretchen, thank you so much.